Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends, the official podcast of Small Town Monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal,
Mark Matzke. That's me.
Last week, we were talking about mysteriously missing people. We did not get to cover all the bases that we wanted to, so we're going back into it for another week of macabre subject matter.
It's like a love-hate relationship with this stuff.
Before we get into this, we should talk about real quick the, if you're listening to this now, it is the day of, I believe. No, this will not be the day of. Let me think. What day is this? April 4th. What is next Friday? Okay. Yeah. If you're listening to this, the Kent Paranormal Weekend kicks off tonight, Friday, April 12th. I will be at, the Kent stage tomorrow for Kent Paranormal Weekend here in Kent, Ohio. And we will be doing a screening of On the Trail of Bigfoot tomorrow night. So if you want to come out to the event, tickets are cheap. They're like $15 for the entire day or something. And you'll get to see this hour and 40 minute cut of On the Trail of Bigfoot on the big screen, which we're excited about. So come out to the event and watch some of these episodes with us. We're excited to do a screening. So the other event that's coming up in 2 weeks is the fourth annual International Cryptozoology Conference featuring Mark Matzke.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Talking about a giant snake that was seen in Peninsula, Ohio. And the thing that's cool about that is it involves, as many of these stories do, a very colorful personality by the name of Robert Bordner. And I've gotten a lot of assistance from Randy Bergdorf, who is the director of the Peninsula Library and Historical Society. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll have a good captive audience that first night on Friday night. So
before they melt down.
Yeah. Oh, right.
From too much cryptid content. Yep. I'll get the melted down audience the next night at 7 PM after they've sat through an entire day of people talking. We're going to do the at least the East Coast premiere of Terror in the Skies. This will be the first audience in the world. It's hard to believe that is in 4 weeks, and it's going to be the first screening of Terror in the Skies to take place anywhere. And I'm sitting here with an unfinished version of the movie in the next room. But we're almost done. Like, basically we just had to add in the animated sequences. The whole movie's cut, and I'm super excited to show it there with Lauren present and Ken. Ken's going to be there too. Right. And Ken's a part of the movie. So,
His presentation's early Saturday then as well. Cool.
Is that about Thunderbirds? Or?
It's In Search Of was in the title of it.
Monsters, probably. He's on a TV show called In Search Of Monsters.
In Search Of Cryptozoology is his official title, and that's at 10 a.m. on Saturday.
I wanted to bash this In Search Of Monsters show real quick that everyone's a part of, apparently. This is the same show that contacted STM wanting us to license content to them for free.
Oh, yes.
So
for free.
Yeah, for free, for credit. Get out of here, TV. So this week we're going back into the mysteriously disappearing people. That's our favorite subject. So do you want to Should we start off with Veach? Can I start off?
Yeah, let's start there.
Okay, let's start with Kenny Veach. So, actually, before I even start talking about it, I'm going to play the audio from Kenny's video. And I found this last night. It's actually on his, I honestly, it might be his YouTube channel still up. So Kenny was a hiker who went mysteriously missing a number of years ago after talking about how he was going out to find what he called the M Cave. And on one of his earlier explorations looking for the M Cave, he had actually recorded this video where he talked about the cave. And so I don't think he goes into great depth here on the cave, but I'm going to play this and then we'll talk a little bit about the cave and what it seemed to mean to Kenny.
Doesn't pick this up very well, but it's a long way. And I just romp around out here, do some solo hikes and have some fun. My mission today is to just do a 1-day hike. It's about 10-hour hike. I got to still go over another ridge and then go all the way down a big crevice that's real narrow and gets kind of scary. I'm looking for a cave that I found, and I didn't have a sidearm when I was here before. And something about that cave just spooked me. Out of all the caves I've ever gone in, this one just made my body vibrate. The closer I got to it, the crazier my body felt. And I was like, all right, I'm not going to go in there right now, but I'm coming back someday. And I talked to some people on YouTube and I told them, hey, I'm coming out here, you know, because they kind of called my hand on it. So I don't know if there's going to be anything to it, but it might be interesting. If I can find it, I got to relocate it. And this is a big mountain range I'm in. And I'm on foot. You know, my truck's way out there.
So Kenny goes missing shortly after that video is made. And again, you can find that video on his YouTube, and I'll have to post some links to it, but I'm going to do a quick rundown of what actually happened to him. But this was pulled from messagetoeagle.com. It's talked about, it's not unusual that people disappear, but the vanishing of Kenny Veach with a V, by the way, as in victory, is truly bizarre. There are several strange aspects about this case, and it's impossible to say what really happened. What did Kenny see and feel when he entered the mysterious cave in the Nevada desert? According to himself, he said shortly before he vanished, there were some supernatural forces in the cave. There are many questions and, once again, few answers. The disappearance of 47-year-old Kenny Veach remains unexplained. Kenny loved hiking, disappeared on Monday, November 10th, 2014. He told his family that he was going on a short overnight trip into the Sheep Mountains in Nevada. 1 month earlier, he had discovered a very strange cave in the Mojave Desert. He said the cave evoked a strange, possibly supernatural occurrence within him, and he wanted to explore it. Kenny wanted to show the world the unusual cave he had discovered, but he did not return home from his trip, and he was never seen again. Before his disappearance, Kenny commented on a YouTube video claiming to have found a cave around Nellis Air Force Base in southern Nevada. Kenny was a brave explorer, and he entered every cave he came across, but this particular cave frightened him. It goes into what he had wrote on, and this is actually this message to eagle.com. This is where I pulled where I found the actual link to his video there. Kenny said that he would return to the cave, bringing a camera and a weapon with him. Kenny made a video, which is what we just played. What happened next is a mystery. All we know is that Kenny returned to the site a month later to find the cave, and he was never seen or heard from again. We can only speculate about what happened to him. Many people have disappeared in the desert, even experienced hikers, but what makes his case unusual is the mysterious M Cave that he was so frightened to enter due to unexplained vibrations. Was something extraordinary hidden in the cave? Was the cave much larger than he expected? Did he perhaps get lost and unable to find his way to the surface? So that's like the quick synopsis of the Veach disappearance. The cave itself is such a interesting piece of this story because you don't often find a paranormal connection to one of these stories. Typically it's something much more sinister, but this is literally a guy setting out to find a cave that he said he felt had supernatural properties and then just disappearing. It's worth noting that he is in the desert, in the Nevada desert, which is not going to be a very friendly environment to begin with. And he's got a gun, but I mean, you could starve, you could become dehydrated. Like, any number of things can happen to you when you're looking in the desert. It's just the fact that we have this added element of a mysterious cave that makes the story so intriguing.
Yeah, and the proximity to Nellis Air Force Base.
Yeah, I was going to say that too.
Raises a ton of questions. Mm-hmm. Really makes you wonder, you know, what vibration type thing he was feeling. If we're talking about, you know, perhaps some weird experimental things going on out there, who knows?
Yeah,
you know, it reminds me of just a total aside, but it reminds me in some ways that video of Grizzly Man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without the grizzlies, obviously, yeah. But the same sort of enterprising spirit, sort of, you know, I don't know what you would say, just sort of a singular sort of personality, kind of explorer type going out by himself. That right there is kind of inadvisable, even if he's
into the wild, would be the other, right. You know, like that same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like it isn't, it's not advisable to do something like that, especially in a terrain. Like in terrain like that. And they said he was a very experienced hiker, knew his way around, did extreme hiking all the time. But I had friends that thought Grizzly Man was this is Spinal Tap style comedy for years. They did not realize it was a documentary.
No kidding.
Yeah, they thought it was a This is Spinal Tap style mockumentary. True story.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, that's one I wanted to get to last week that we didn't get to touch upon. And just there really isn't much to the story. A guy found a cave and then he went looking for it and never was seen again. But I think because of that, all sorts of people have gone out in those deserts trying to find him and trying to find the cave. And now it's like kind of a big paranormal legend is built up around this. Is this a missing 411 case?
I don't know if it would be. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, the remarkable thing to me is the video trail. You know, the fact that he's...
Oh, you can see exactly where he was. Yeah. And like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one, though. Good
it
story.
Is. Yeah, you just... Why... Do you happen to know why... did he call it M Cave?
I was going
to
ask you that.
Yeah.
I thought he said the opening was shaped like an M.
Okay.
And I think that was why he called it the M Cave. That's but I'm not...
I'm
not 100% sure. I was reading this last night in bed as I was getting ready for
that. Oh, yeah. That's a good sleep-inducing story.
Yeah, it's nice.
Oh, my. So I have a couple more from my kidnapping file that I'd like to share.
Yeah, please.
One is, of course, highly disturbing, but it's has great historical significance, and it's the story of Amber Hagerman from Arlington, Texas. This is January 1996. She was 9 years old, and evidently an eyewitness saw her being forced off of her bike by an unknown man into a black pickup truck. And 4 days later, her body was found in a drainage ditch, and remains unsolved to this day. The media broadcasters in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where this took place devised a rapid warning system that launched in 1997 and was in all 50 states by 2005, and it's called Amber Alert.
I was going to say,
Hundreds of abducted children have been brought home safe. Thanks to Amber and her remaining family members do take some solace in knowing that her unnecessary and tragic death has at least helped out, you know, hundreds of other kids to get back home. So I kind of ran across this with looking at other cases, and I thought it was worth mentioning that the Amber Alert that's now sort of unfortunately a part of all of our lives, that began in a very personal way for one family.
So. It's interesting. I'm curious to know how many people that do something like that get away with it, because they never found this guy. Like there's no leads.
No, just I mean, they had enough to say it's a black pickup truck.
Yeah,
and it was a male. Obviously, some type of description would have been able to be offered, but not enough to pinpoint the person.
And that's Texas.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to give another one, and then I'll get into the maybe we'll save mine for last because it's less terrifying.
Okay. Well, I think what we generally try to do at some point is bring this home, and one extremely famous kidnapping that still has shockwaves in our area is the sort of the triple kidnapping of the women by Ariel Castro.
Mm-hmm.
The women involved were Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus. And this was all around 2002. Michelle Knight was abducted in 2002. In August, Amanda Berry, April 2003, and Gina DeJesus in 2004. Ariel Castro, who is the man responsible for all of their abductions, was himself killed in prison in September 2013. And so sort of from 2002 to 2013, that story held sway in the Cleveland area and was always being talked about in some fashion, especially, of course, after the women were discovered. And then the trial and everything.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about how they were found? Because that was like a big part of the...
Oh, yeah. So really what ended up happening is that the women were, quote unquote, held captive, but it was more a psychological captivity than it was in like being chained to a post or something of that nature. And just gradually, one of the women in particular, and I forget which one it is, without looking too carefully at the notes, started to test the waters and see, you know, if there were any soft spots in Castro's defenses. I mean, he was enough of a manipulator that he would pretend to leave and then see if any of them would try to escape and then catch them. And then he would abuse them horribly to condition them not to try it again. But one of them did get out, and there was a neighbor by the name of Charles Ramsey who saw this happening and actually helped her, I think, break through a screen door to get out to safety. And he was hailed as a hero for a time in the local media, and then his life sort of devolved into something bad. I forget what happened to him.
Yeah.
But so, you know, what they were facing, what these women faced day in and day out were rooms that became de facto jail cells. There were chains attached to the walls and ceilings in the basement, and Castro fed them basically once a day. They bathed only when Castro deemed it necessary. And of the three, Michelle Knight was treated the worst. She had her jaw broken by Castro. And really the horrible part of the story, she became pregnant 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
Upon her release, she has since changed her name in an attempt to really start clean, start over. Castro played them against each other. You know, as a master manipulator, he was part of his game was to get them not to trust each other. In part, I think, to keep them from working together to get out, but really sort of establish a pecking order between the three. And in another weird twist, Gina DeJesus was actually close friends with Castro's daughter. And that's how when Castro came along one day and offered to give her a ride, she accepted because she knew him and had no idea what she was getting into by accepting that ride, except it was to his home.
Well,
not,
see, I don't know anything about him. So he was just like kind of perceived initially as like a normal dude. Like he had.
Yeah, he was throughout this entire experience. He was a bus driver for the Cleveland public school system. He maintained a normal veneer, and he actually, I mean, to keep up the facade, he attended public vigils for DeJesus.
Oh, wow.
Played in a band that did like a benefit concert for Gina DeJesus and then went home.
Yeah.
And she was there in the basement or in one of the bedrooms. I mean, it was extremely like you have this almost split personality. I don't know that was ever diagnosed in him, but he was able to separate out these ways of being in the community to give people no sense that there was something unusual happening.
But they're at least recovered in this situation. Amanda went on to do, she was on like a local TV station.
She still is.
She still is. Okay.
After researching this, I happened to see her on the news one morning talking about disappearances. So
yeah, that's her. Yeah.
She's leveraged that into helping other people, which is really commendable. I think, you know, you asked about him. His life started to spiral downward after his divorce, which happened in 1996. He had 4 children with a woman named Grimelda Figueroa.
Mm-hmm.
And so spent, you know, he was able to maintain the facade as well by spending most of his time outside of the home,
mm-hmm.
whether that was at concerts or he participated in searches for these women.
So weird.
It
is a bizarre.
Yeah. And vigils for the women. Knight would go on to write a book called Finding Me. DeJesus and Barry wrote a book together as well. And the home at 2207 Seymour Avenue was demolished on August 7th, 2013. But that hasn't stopped people from going to that neighborhood to this day to take pictures at the vacant lot and stuff. And the residents of that neighborhood really are beyond sick and tired of it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they just want to, they see themselves to this very day as a tight-knit community. They look out for each other. That's partially why this failure and this lapse hit them so hard, because they just found it beyond the pale that this could have happened right under their noses. I mean, people were in that house on numerous occasions, family members, and they heard sounds occasionally, but they thought it was a dog or a pet that was locked in a bedroom or something like that. And so, I mean, it became, in sort of their own words, a sick, polygamous, quote-unquote, family. I mean, like a bizarro, very disturbing family. But that's what Castro seemed to be trying to construct for himself, you know, in the wake of one family that had fallen apart.
Just formed using, another.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Lost Colony of Roanoke, 1588. So this is another one of these stories that I'm fascinated by and I'm kind of a fan of. Most Americans know the story of the Lost Colony. It dates back to the time the Europeans began to settle on this free land that is now known as Virginia. The village of Roanoke was one of the first English colonies to be established on the soil. However, this village did not turn out to be that of a successful one. The governor of this hamlet had the name of John White. The small population of Roanoke complained about their lack of food and tools. They also contained frightening suspicions that the natives may launch a surprise attack on them. These complaints eventuated in John White going to England to later return, along with proper supplies the colonists requested. John White returned 3 long years afterward, but what he returned to was not that of a colony, but of a ghost town. The area, which was once a village, was stripped of its people. Houses and other shelters were nowhere on site. What was left behind were some small cannons, an open chest, a tall fence built around the perimeter of the former village site, and a single word inscribed on a fence post that read Croatoan. What do you know about this story?
Well, there's all sorts of theories about what happened to them.
I have a whole list.
Well, yeah, and they're fascinating, including sort of the one that I find the most interesting, just personally, is that they sort of were just absorbed into the native culture.
Local native tribes absorbed the colonists as friends or slaves, is the very first one. Yeah.
And then after that, there were people of a certain complexion that were...
Yeah.
You know, just seen in the area.
Yeah.
And to me, that's, I don't know, that's kind of a, in some ways, that's a very North American story.
I was going to say, it seems very American in a way. Like, if they were there and they were, you know, like obviously there's a chance or like a pretty good, I think it's the most believable of the theories is that they were just sort of absorbed into the local native tribes. And 3 years is an exceptionally long period of time. You think about 3 years in a place where you were already having a hard time surviving. So I've always thought that was an interesting. There's an island named Croatoan just south of Roanoke, and it's home to a Native American tribe of the same name. Since the settlers developed a good rapport with the tribe and they carved Croatoan on the fort's gatepost, many assume the settlers moved to the island and were absorbed into the tribe. Another is that they may have just moved inland, perhaps driven off by Spanish troops. Some theorize they moved north to join the Chesapeake tribe or perhaps the Chowanocs or Wipomoacs in the years after the colony disappeared. Many people reported seeing Europeans and European-made goods in the area, though it was mostly hearsay. That's the one that this list I'm looking at spends the most amount of time on. Another is that the colonists fell victim to cannibalism or practice it themselves. Unlike the Croatoans, other Native American tribes may have been more hostile to the Roanoke colonists. There's a theory that a cannibalistic tribe could have attacked and eaten the British colonists. If true, that would explain why no bodies were ever found. That's disturbing, though. I don't want to think about that.
Yeah.
Edgar Allan Poe had a mysterious connection to the word Croatoan. The whereabouts of the Roanoke colony isn't the only part of this mystery. Archaeologists and historians are still trying to figure out why the word Croatoan was carved into the post. Were the colonists saying the Croatoan tribe would know what happened to them? While we still don't know, the word Croatoan is connected to another strange event centuries later. Not much is known about the death of Edgar Allan Poe in 1849. After disappearing on a trip from Virginia to Pennsylvania, he turned up nearly unconscious and babbling incoherently in a gutter in Baltimore, Maryland. While on his deathbed, Poe allegedly whispered the word Croatoan. And then they don't really know how he died either, by the way. Which is kind of funny. I mean, knowing Poe, he probably just did it to mess with everyone. He's laying there and he's like, Croatoan.
One more in the chamber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, do I pull this one? Croatoan appears at the site of many other mysterious disappearances. By the way, I'm pulling this from ranker.com, a reputable website, more reputable website you'll never find. This mysterious word also reportedly showed up in other places. Infamous stagecoach robber Black Bart supposedly etched the word into the wall of his prison cell right before his release in 1888, and he was never seen again. Horror author Ambrose Bierce vanished while in Mexico in 1913, and the bed he slept in allegedly had the word Croatoan carved into a post. The word also appears on the last page of the logbook of the ghost ship Carol A. Deering in 1921, which ran aground without its crew on Cape Hatteras near what was once known as Croatoan Island. And Amelia Earhart reportedly scribbled the word in her journal found after her disappearance in 1937.
So we've just come full circle.
We're back. Like I know. I kind of feel like let's just kill everything right there, and we're back at the beginning. There's more theories about. Most of them revolve around variations of like a native tribe doing something to them. And in this case, it's an infectious disease drove the colonists mad. Reports of Native American tribes claiming to witness internal warfare among the Roanoke colonists. Archaeologists also theorize the Roanoke settlers contracted a plague. Spanish troops murdered the colonists. Colonists were sabotaged as part of a plan to discredit Sir Walter Raleigh. Colonists tried to sail back to England. Croatoan tribe executed the colonists as suspected witches, which is really just, you know, that's just a variation on.
Right.
Roanoke was the site of a zombie apocalypse. Another theory some folks like to share on the internet claims Roanoke served as a ground zero for some kind of zombie apocalypse. This combines aspects of other theories that the colonists were diseased and became cannibals. According to this idea, the settlers became infected with a zombie virus that gave them insatiable hunger for human flesh and hastened the decaying process of their own bodies. Their remains would have been long gone, and the infestation would have been over before White returned. The Roanoke colonists were transformed into trees. Now we're talking.
There we go. I didn't want to say that.
Yeah, one. I was waiting for you to bring that up. The Croatoan tribe reportedly believed the island had a spirit who, if angered, had the ability to absorb the offenders into the woods, literally. The spirit could transform them into trees, stones, animals, or anything else in nature. If this lore is taken at face value, that means no one actually went missing. They just became a part of the land. The reptilian devil of the woods possessed the colonists. I don't know at this point if these are made up theories or not.
Some of these are X-Files episodes, I'm pretty sure.
The Croatoans believed that greater spirits manifested themselves in the form of elements, and they reported a strange phenomenon that occurred at the same time as the vanishing of the colonists. Birds fell from the sky, and large numbers of wildlife died abruptly in the area where the native people hunted. The Croatoans told of an evil spirit that took the form of a reptile. They said it was able to attach itself to humans, causing them to demonstrate the demonic traits like violence, rapaciousness, and greed. The Croatoans warned the colonists that the evil reptilian spirit had infested the entire region, and once the infighting began, They knew the settlers were infected with the creature's evil, and that's why they turned on each other. They might have been victims of witches. The Dare Stones tell the story of the missing colonists from 1937 to 1941. People began uncovering in gravestones supposedly written by members of the Roanoke colony. Man claimed to have found the first stone, a 21-pound rock, somewhere along the Carolina coast. It's believed that Eleanor Dare used it to write a message to her father, John White. In the alleged account, Dare says the colonists moved further away from the ocean a short time after White embarked for England, but they were plagued with illness and violent encounters with native tribes until only 7 colonists remained. I don't like that verse. That's sad. Aliens abducted the colonists. Here we go.
Yeah.
You know, a mystery is extremely mysterious when an alien abduction seems like a logical explanation. That is one of the explanations for the missing colonists. Virginia Dare survived and was turned into a beautiful white doe is another theory. But anyway, that's my addition to the mysterious missing. I like when a sad story has an ending that can offer us these fun little rabbit trails, right? Like the Roanoke. More than likely, to me anyway, more than likely they went off and lived with another native tribe. That's always just, it made the most sense.
Yeah, and I mean, regardless of the theory, what that reminds you of is just the extreme vulnerability of these settlers. I mean, you just try to imagine what that would be like coming across the ocean and not really knowing what you're getting into in terms of just the scope of North America. And there you are in your little fort, you know, imagining what, you know, like, what are you even there to do? Well, and then there's this gigantic continent full of things trying to.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, a lot of these stories echo that.
Yeah.
Like, not necessarily the more, you know, the more mundane, like, kidnappings, but Veach kind of has elements of, you know, going into a place you don't know and probably being ill-equipped to deal with it.
Yeah.
And the Roanoke colonists, obviously, but the other one that springs to mind might be the American Dyatlov incident.
Right.
You know, you've got these 5 kids that are mysteriously missing and found on the side of this mountain. I mean, if there isn't anything paranormal to that, then more than likely they drove up there for some idiotic reason and all proceeded to die. You know, I mean, unless they were taken there. So, do you want to sum up the missing?
Sure.
The mysteriously missing?
Well, I forget if it was this episode or the previous episode, but you'd asked about some stats, and I do have just a collection of them, I think, to go out to consider some of these things.
Yeah.
This was from 2010. In 2010, the United States ranked 6th in the world in kidnapping for ransom.
Wow. It's kind of sad for a supposedly civilized.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you have a phobia of kidnapping, then you probably want to avoid Phoenix, Arizona. Hmm. In 2010, there were 370 cases of kidnapping taking place in Phoenix, making it 2nd only to Mexico City in the world.
No kidding.
Yes. Oh. chart your course accordingly. But also another statistic that I found that I thought was somewhat significant is that a non-custodial parent abduction is by far the number one cause of child kidnapping. 40% of abductors who take children for sexual purposes end up killing them. So it's very dire. I mean, it's really very dark. And I would hate to be someone who would have to try to offer counsel to a family in that situation, because the statistics they're not good in terms of having hope. And some last comments here. I mean, these stories, some of them at least, they tap into the extremely primal fear that someone's going to abduct your child, or that someone you love is going to be there one day and not be there the next. And there was one author that wrote this sentence. I can't take credit for this, but it's really sort of haunting. It says, "It's a voice that keeps calling us back from the reality that 90% of child abuse is committed by family members and acquaintances."
90? Wow.
So, you know, it's one thing, and I think for obvious reasons, so many people, and us included, I think, are fascinated by disappearances. Mm-hmm. But kidnapping is really a type of abuse.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I mean, the stories, what they all point to as the author of that sentence is getting at, it's people that you know and may not suspect, but it just is it's a wake-up call, I think, to trust but verify.
You can find, now that we've hit our two sober episodes, lifetime sober episode commitment, you can find Sasquatch on most podcatchers and on social media. Leave us a rating and review if you feel so inclined, and visit smalltownmonsters.com. There's a page directly for Monsteropolis and Sasquatch, the old show. So thanks for listening. Back next week. See you at Kent Paranormal Weekend or the International Cryptozoology Conference.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.